2.
Hey folks, and welcome to this week's edition of the podcast. Michael Shelley here with you. I don't know if you've been listening to the actual radio show, but about a month or two ago, I started broadcasting live from the basement. So Saturday mornings, with the help of my daughter, my wife, I am broadcasting 100% live from the basement of our house, Studio B-, we call it, and it's certainly interesting. And I'll tell you one thing about this strange lockdown period we're in is that it's really brought listeners together. There's an incredible community on the message board, the chat board for the program, which is on the playlist for each show. So I urge you, if you're looking for something to do on Saturday mornings, tune into the show. It's really become something different during these weird times. So let's talk about today's guest. Rocky Pamplin was a bodyguard, although I kind of think in retrospect maybe he was guarding Brian Wilson from himself. He's one of the only folks close to the Beach Boys who never had to sign a confidentiality agreement, and so he was free to write this book. I think this book has sort of been kicking around for a while, and Ron Hammondy stepped in and sort of, you know, shaped it up to publishing shape, and it's something that would definitely interest folks who are looking for another view on what happened. There's many different views, and I'm not sure which one is the correct one. But you can check the archives, wfmu.org/Michael. I've interviewed Brian Wilson, Mike Love, David Marks, Blondie Chapman, Billy Hinchy, a lot of folks who have traveled with, played with, are the Beach Boys, a lot of authors who've written books. It's an endless fascination for me. And if you're interested, go to wfmu.org/Michael. Check out those archives. The Beach Boys, Endless Wave, Inside America's Band, Rushton, Rocky, Pamplin, and Ron Hammondy. I hope you'll find this interesting. Rocky is an irrepressible guy, and I think you'll get to know a little bit about him and his time with Brian. So stay tuned, enjoy. Hope you're all well. Be safe. Talk to you soon. Okay, I want to say good morning to Rocky Pamplin and Ron Hammondy. They have written this book I've been telling you about called The Beach Boys' Endless Wave Inside America's Band. It's great to have you guys with me this morning. Rocky, you were an eyewitness to what went down. I've read, 5 million Beach Boy books, and they're usually not written by someone who was in the room. So it's really interesting to hear a first-person account and to fill in some of the holes in the story. And let me just make a long story short. You were friends with Stan Love, and Stephen Love was the manager of the band at that time, and Stan and Steve got you to start working for the Wilsons. Marilyn hired you. So what year would this have been?
This would have been 1976, and yes, Stan was my roommate in college, and Steve Love was the manager because they had Mike Love, the older brother, who was the cousin of Brian, who started the Beach Boys. So, 1976.
So, was it a 24-hour-a-day job? Did you live in the house?
I lived there. And I had my own apartment in Santa Monica, but I don't think I was ever there. In fact, I gave the keys to a friend of mine who needed a place for 6 months. But anyway, and it was a full-time job, and it was also exciting. I was hanging out with my friend Stan Love, who was a former Los Angeles Laker basketball player. But, I just moved to L.A., so it was like, let's try to help some guy get off of drugs.
Yeah, to go right into the fast lane is amazing. So when Marilyn hired you, how did she describe the job to you? Because I've seen it sort of, you're referred to as a bodyguard, which is sort of a catch-all. But what did she say she wanted you and Stan to do?
Well, the bottom line was, Stanley had been working for Brian for a while, and I would say that the job description was trying to save some guy's life. In other words, trying to, save, do for somebody else what he couldn't do for himself. He was in the throes of addiction. And I actually met Brian first that day before I met Marilyn. Stanley and I had this conversation about college, and we got him interested. And we got him to come in the office and want to talk to us. And that's something he never did. He was oblivious. This guy never talked to anybody. So that was our plan, was to try to get him to take an interest in us. And
It's kind of amazing. There are some really super sad stories and some funny stories about the links that Brian would go to get sometimes food or drugs and alcohol, and the links you would have to go to stop him. Were you familiar from your previous life with that level of addiction, and what was your reaction to being so close to that behavior?
No, I wasn't familiar with it at all, and I'll be honest with you, I mentioned this to Ron earlier. I don't talk about this much, but the first time I met Brian, when we walked out of the house and went to the chauffeur's car, I was almost shaking. I said, God, this guy is so screwed up. What? I mean, I saw what drugs had done. He'd been in bed for, you know, a long time, almost a decade, doing heroin and cocaine. And anyway, to see somebody whose nervous system is totally impaired, and he can't talk, he can't see you, everybody, he's oblivious. He's walking through his house, he can't even see me in Stanley. So it scared me. I felt so bad for him. Like, he'd given the world this beautiful music, and this poor guy is this tortured soul.
Yeah. So you guys start working with him, you start doing all kinds of stuff. Tell me on a good day what your routine was like with Brian Wilson. Like, well, when did it start? Walk me through the whole thing.
Well, first of all, not to let him just have anything he wanted to eat, like 10 eggs and, you know, 4 pieces of toast and hash browns slathered and butter and hash browns and ketchup and, you know, this, you know, when we took that stuff away from him, his only way to get high was to take this great big beaker, you know, glass, and put like 8 heaping tablespoons of, coffee that's instant coffee, and then he would just fill it up with hot water from his thing, and he would chug it, and he would go and lay on the couch and pant. He'd do anything to get high. I mean, I know I didn't answer your question entirely, but so that was the first thing, is to stop that. And then just, you know, regular breakfast, and get him out of the house by like 9 after a shower and small breakfast, and get him to the gym to play basketball, which he actually liked to do. He loved to dribble. He wasn't any good at, you know, any other aspect of it, but he loved to dribble. And then we would take him to the psychiatrist in Beverly Hills and drop him off, and Stanley and I would hang around Beverly Hills, and an hour later we'd take him home and have another small meal, you know. But anyway, so as far as the whole day, as time went on, that worked. We got his weight way down, and then eventually we got him in the recording studio, and that was a big deal. He didn't want to write music. He didn't want to know nothing from music. And then eventually we even got him the tour. So, you know, the whole escapade of it took us, you know, about a year to get him to that point, to where he was touring again.
Yeah. I mean, you're not a psychologist, right? But in your opinion, is the thing that haunted Brian Wilson, was it a result of physical or mental trauma, or was it the after effects of drugs, or was it just something he was born with? Like, if he had if he had been a farmer or had some other occupation, would he still have faced these mental challenges?
Yeah, I think Brian would have heard voices no matter what. In fact, I think like you said, I'm not a doctor, but when I saw him, I knew that this guy was not like me or Stan or anyone else I knew. I mean, he was seriously, not just the nervous system, but he was somewhere else. And he was scared to death of everybody. He used to take his hand, put it right by his eyes, and his hand would be shaking just to hide. I mean, it was frightening because you felt so sorry for him, you know, that he was damaged. And I thought, is there any way we're going to be able to help repair this guy? And we weren't doctors, but I knew it looked really bad, you know, and my heart just sank. I died 1,000 deaths. I still am when I think about it, because he gave us so much beautiful music. And I looked at him, I thought, how could anybody who gave us all this could be so tortured?
Yeah, that's really the mystery. I mean, it's just the saddest thing. Let me ask you. Yeah, when he finally got back to the studio, I think that is when they were making the Beach Boys' "Love You" record, which is really largely just Brian. So, were you in the studio hanging around during all that time?
I came in right at the end of that. We did the last few songs, or I was with them then, and then we started working on another album, "Smile." Which, anyway, he didn't finish that again. Just getting Brian back in the studio and the band showing up and Brian taking over, we used to give him pep talks like on the way to this rehearsal. Brian, you're the Beach Boys. That's your old life. Your new life is you got to take charge of the music and these people and be your old self in the new life, you know. And he would do it. It's amazing. It didn't, not at first, but you know, to watch him come back, to see the progress. It took months and months and months, took a year to get the 100 pounds off him. Then after that, we got him to quit smoking cigarettes. I mean, that in itself, I mean, there are so many things. I'm sorry, I kind of lost sight of your question because it's all kind of, you know, when I think about it, it's like it's happening right now.
One of the things that you talk about in the book, and there's a, I'll remind folks, the book is called "The Beach Boys' Endless Wave: Inside America's Band." And one of the there's so many stories in the book, but one of the things that is so tough is that there's if you turn your back for 5 seconds, there's always somebody around who wants to be with a famous guy and will just give him whatever he wants. That's so frustrating.
Well, you have to be careful where you go. I mean, if you're going to be at the Troubadour or somewhere, you're in big trouble. But and one of the good things about Brian is he liked to just stay at home. But that was just, he was hiding. He never wanted to leave or do anything.
Why do you think he trusted you guys? I mean, was it earned or was he lonely?
It took forever. I mean, I told Ron this. I rarely spoke to Brian. And I was just there at his house all the time. And when I spoke, I would talk very softly and very few words, and I knew that that's what would get him to open up to me and trust me a little bit, to know that I didn't want anything from him. Hmm. I was there to help in any way I could, you know. So, but that took 6 months before he even thought out enough to talk to me, I think. I mean, he used to just stay upstairs. Then occasionally, eventually he came down into the, I used to stay in the living room where I could play the piano and see the stairs, and if he came out of his bedroom, I'd be the first one to see him. And eventually he walks in there one day, and he walks past me, and I'm singing, playing Surfer Girl, I think it was, or whatever song it was, but he comes back to me, he actually shows me a what's called an inversion on the piano. Because you can play C three different ways. And he shows me it. And I kind of got, you don't have to move your hands all over the place. Anyway, it was a huge thing. But that was the first time I think he talked to me.
At that time, he had two young daughters. Was he any kind of a father at all?
No. I mean, he had the sweetest heart in the world, but he was out to lunch. So that first year, yeah, these 7 and 9 year old girls are running around the house, and they're used to it. Their dad has never participated in their life, so they're not expecting them to. Yeah. But it was not normal, and it was bizarre, and I felt sorry for them. Yeah. And Brian would try from time to time to be like a father, but, you know, he was so screwed up, he was impaired. He couldn't actually. If he tried to be normal around him, he didn't look normal. You know, he would scare them in a sense. You know,
if I can just jump in for a second, Michael. In hearing all these stories, I realized that they were lucky to get Rocky in that house because Brian, for whatever reason, and you can never tell with a guy like that, that sort of wandered off. Like somebody, and he liked Rocky. And there's a really wonderful moment in the book where Brian asked you if you heard voices. Isn't that correct, Rocky?
Yeah, it was like the first week I went in the jacuzzi, and he kept walking by in the kitchen. I never thought he'd come out. I mean, he didn't take any. But the third trip where he came out in shorts, and he got in the jacuzzi with me. And Michelle, he goes, so you and Stan were roommates in college? And I said, yeah. He goes, and you were a football player? And I said, right. And he goes, I was a football player too, you know. I played football in college. I was a quarterback. And I said, oh, yeah. He goes, well, I was only second string. But anyway, then about that time, Stan comes out and gets in with us. And, you know, we got shorts on. But and the Marilyn, the wife, and her sister Diane are in the kitchen, and they're looking. And I can read their lips, like going, "What in the hell is this?" Brian never talks to anybody. And so right about then, Brian says, "Do you ever hear voices?" I mean, it was so like just. And I said, "No, I can't say as though I do. Why do you?" And he goes, "Oh yeah." I go, "Well, what do the voices say?" I mean, this took about a minute though, and he goes, "Oh, you don't want to know. It's scary." But anyway, and that's where Stan jumps in and goes, well, look, man, this is the new football season, your new life. You're going to score a bunch of touchdowns. We're going to be on tour. And, you know, forget about all that. But, see, I knew that then. So this is probably day 4 or 5. Brian was hearing voices. And, nope, I mean, I'm shocked he even told me. But because he never spoke to anybody.
Yeah.
Even for the next year, I never see him. He would never talk to anybody. He was whatever that is.
So that's what's so fascinating about this, how Rocky got behind the veil of that whole Beach Boys organization. Mm-hmm. No one else ever had. And Rocky ended up there because he was friends with Stanley, who was Brian's cousin. And when Rocky went there, Karen didn't make him sign a non-disclosure agreement.
Marilyn, the wife, Marilyn.
Sorry, Marilyn didn't make Rocky sign a non-disclosure agreement. Everybody that worked for that band had to sign a non-disclosure agreement. So Rocky was one of the few people that ever got behind the veil to see what was going on in the interaction between the three Love brothers and the three Wilson brothers. And Rocky, you know, I noticed it. I used to be in the music business and manage bands, etc. And I don't think Rocky knows that deft touch that he and Stanley brought to Brian's life was what really saved Brian's life. If it hadn't been these two guys and their personalities, Brian could have gone the way of Elvis, you know, but they knew how to reach him. It's an extraordinary story.
Well, it's something we tried to have a soft touch with him because we knew he looked like a person who'd been battered, and he was scared to death. So what are you going to do? You know, all you want to do is make it as easy as possible and be as sweet to him as you can. And he was a sweetheart of a guy. I swear you to know him is to love him. No kidding.
Ron, you said that Brian could have wound up like Elvis, or he could have wound up closer to home, more like Dennis, you know, and Dennis is in the book is he's not exactly the villain, but he kind of is the villain of the book. Rocky and Dennis did
kind of
not
a star too.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of describe him as being very charismatic and just full of trouble. From the very first time you guys see each other, you don't get along, and you end up... there's
didn't
a great...
read the book.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, you end up in court, and it doesn't go well. Again, you know, Dennis, was it just the circumstance that he went through, or was it something he was born to just be that way?
You know... Dennis said there was a point where he rented Will Rogers' house, who had passed away, and it was on Sunset Boulevard right before you get to the Palisades. And he was there for 4 years, and it was one big orgy. Everybody would come over, and everybody brought drugs, and he even said, the takeaway from this was those 4 years, he told people this, those 4 years destroyed him. He never recovered from it, the drug and the lifestyle, and so there you have it. This is before Brian even, you know, had his mental breakdown.
You mention in the book Mike and Brian's recent books, and I'm curious, there's so many people who have a horse in the game, you know, in the race, and when you read those kind of things, are those books what you see as reality?
Okay, I'm not going to knock your books. I love Brian, but these guys tell the story they want to tell. And most of it, I hate to say this, I think he mentioned me once, and I helped save his life, Brian. And I know Mike, you know, tells more of the story about him and Stanley, and Stephen loved hiring us, but these guys have their own story, and it has nothing to do with reality.
Well, you have a story to tell, and like I said earlier, it is rare to get that first-person look at any sort of history, especially one that has so many different viewpoints, like the Beach Boys story. I imagine for you and Ron, there were some pushback from, I don't know, fans or people just close to the band who didn't agree, Rocky, with your version or didn't want it to be told just because they want to keep it a little more squeaky clean. Did that happen? Did you guys have to deal with that?
Oh, I don't think so, Mike, because of what you said. I wasn't just some guy. I lived there in his house. I've saved his life. So unless I'm lying, what I'm telling people is the real deal. So, other people didn't have much to say about that. I mean, in fact, I think everybody appreciates it. It's like you can tell when somebody's telling you the truth. And especially intimate details, especially of famous people's lives that you would never hear otherwise.
There were people, though, Michael, that took exception to the credit that we gave Mike Love in that book. There's a Mike Love camp and there's a Brian Wilson camp, and sometimes those two camps are at odds with each other. And when I listened to Rocky talking about all of his experiences when the book was being edited, I said, you know, that should be in the book, Rocky. That should be in the book, Rocky. That should be in the book. He just told me story after story after story.
And Ron put them all in the book.
Well, I put a bunch of them in the book, and it really fleshed things out, I think, considerably. But the one thing that Rocky did not realize was his tremendous respect for Mike Love. When Rocky would talk about how that band survived, Mike Love was the glue that held that band together.
Well, once again, the book is called The Beach Boys' Endless Wave, Inside America's Band, Ron Hammondy and Rocky Pamplin. I wish you guys good luck, and I thank you so much for sharing the stories with us today.
Michael, it's a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark.
My girlfriend Betty, she's always ready to help me in any way. She'd do my cooking, she's always looking for ways she can make my day. And when I'm looking at her, the sound of bitter batter on rainy days like today can get you feeling warmer, and you know what that can lead to. Maybe it won't last, but what do we care? My baby and I just want a good time. Might go up in smoke now, but what do we care? My baby and I just want a good time. My girlfriend Penny, she's kinda skinny, and so she needs her falsies on. She don't like cooking, but she's so good looking, I miss her when she's gone. And when she gets to dancing, I feel just like romancing, especially when we're dancing close. She'll do the dirty boogie, and that's when I go up in smoke.